Welcome to Connecting the Notes. I'm your host, Matthew Ray. In this hour, we will be listening to the music of Dwight Twilley. Dwight Twilley was kind enough to talk with the show earlier this week. We'll be hearing segments of that interview in the coming hour, so stick around as we talk rock and roll with Dwight Twilley. Dwight Twilley Band with Feeling in the Dark, released in 1976. The core of the group included singer-songwriter and multi-instrumentalist Dwight Twilley, drummer Phil Seymour, and guitarist Bill Pitcock IV. All three musicians hail from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Two-part vocal harmonies you hear in many of these early songs were sung by Twilley and drummer Phil Seymour. The two originally met in 1967 at a screening of A Hard Day's Night in Tulsa and began playing music together that day. Dwight Twilley was kind enough to talk with the show earlier in the week, and here he is recounting the early days of his friendship with Phil Seymour.
The first thing I kind of wanted to know, and you know, we can skip the story about you and Phil Seymour meeting, and I think it's been pretty well documented. But I was wondering about your level of musicianship and whether you two had been writing songs before you met, or if it was something you brought out in each other.
Phil never didn't write songs till later on in his career. When we met, I was the guy writing the songs.
But you were both playing different instruments?
Yeah, he was like a drummer, and I picked up guitar and piano.
When did you start writing songs?
I think I was about 15. I found my little brother's abandoned Stella guitar, which is your high-quality, like a $29 Sears guitar, and his closet that he had abandoned as he lost interest in it, and I thought, you know, it'd be really cool to, like, play Beatles songs. And so I tried to play Beatles songs, and I realized that I didn't know enough about music to, you know, come up with the right chords to play them. So I just started writing my own songs. And I just kind of became infatuated with it.
Do you remember when you actually realized or became capable of actually holding a note singing, you know, and realizing that you two had such nice vocal harmonies that could accompany each other?
You know, it seemed like pretty early on, because, you know, the infamous story you alluded to about when we first met, that actually, literally the day that we first got together, I think we'd seen each other just for a few, you know, brief encounters, you know, through schoolmates and so on, but the first day that we were actually met somewhere and spent a little time together, we went back to, I think it was my house, and we recorded that day.
You were so warm, you melted me in your arms. You were so young, you made me come undone. Anyway, I told you before that.
Eventually, skipping down the road quite a bit, you went in search of, in search of bringing your band somewhere. Mm-hmm. And your first stop was Sun Records, just coincidentally, where Sam Phillips' brother, Sud, referred you to Ray Harris.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was all a complete accident. We were just little naive kids that, we kind of were like little type folky guys with our little harmonies and my little songs. And we got in my 58 Chevy station wagon. We had a cassette tape of some of our songs. And we couldn't afford to go all the way to L.A. or to New York, so we figured the closest thing we could do would be like to go to Memphis as far as where, you know, we might find a real record company. And so we drove into Memphis, and we're just going down the street going, where is a let's find a record company or a recording studio. The first place we see is this sign said Sun Records, and we had no idea what that meant. We had no idea, we knew about Elvis, but to us, Elvis was a guy that was in movies, and the Beatles had invented rock and roll. We had all that straight, and so it was just a total coincidence, and actually, when you were talking about our voices, this guy, Jerry Phillips, heard us and liked us, and hooked us up with this old Sun Records early artist term producer named Ray Harris, and sent us down to, of all places, Tupelo, Mississippi, which gave us quite an education, as you can imagine. And and he was the first one that just, frankly said, you all sing like pussies. And so we worked with him for a while, and when we came back to Tulsa after many trips back and forth and getting beat up by him, we didn't sing like pussies anymore.
Is it safe to assume you didn't know who Ray Harris was at the time?
No, we didn't know who he was. We didn't really know much about Sun Records or, the early rock and roll. So in a way, I think that's one of the things that really set us aside from other groups like us at that time, because that kind of really influenced us and kind of bled into what we were doing, instead of a lot of bands at the time were just, you know, they too just thought the Beatles invented rock and roll and Elvis was a guy in movies. And we sort of learned that Elvis played a big part in rock and roll. And so, you know, there became kind of a British rockabilly sound that, you know, resulted.
So by the time you actually cut your first single, which was I'm on Fire, mm-hmm. were you pretty confident in the type of music that you and Dwight were going to make? Or did it change once you got access to the big studio and the producers? And
No, because we had spent a year or so going back and forth to Tupelo and kind of being educated down there. And then we hooked up with a guy named Bill Pickock IV, who became our guitar player. And his grandfather owned an electric company, an old electric company here in Tulsa, and it was called Pickock Electric. And he let us have a few rooms up above where the main shop, they called it, was to, kind of like a rehearsal room, which we turned into our own little TIAC four-track studio. And, you know, between the two of those, you know, our real focus in those days was most important to us was the art of making records. And so we didn't go much further and make big efforts to try to get signed by a label or anything till we really thought we were ready. And so at that point, I think somewhere in 74 or something, we'd spent so much time working in Tupelo and then working in our laboratory at Pickock Electric that we really felt confident that now we could take our recordings that we'd made at Pickock Electric and just matter-of-factly go out to Hollywood and get a record deal.
You heard Dwight Twilley talking about his meeting with Ray Harris. Ray Harris is a singer, songwriter, and producer. Dwight learned a lot about the rock and roll sound from Harris. If you're unfamiliar with him, here's Ray Harris with Come On Little Mama.
Well, and I still young, 12 o'clock, me and my baby gonna rock, 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 come on, little baby. Come on, sweet mama. Come on, little baby, everybody rock tonight. Oh, my pretty legs to my knees, mama, mama, play house with me. Come on, come on, come on.
The Dwight Twilley Band secured a record deal with Shelter Records, a Tulsa-based label founded by Leon Russell and Denny Cordell in 1974. Early artists signed to this label included J.J. Cale, The Gap Band, Freddie King, and Tom Petty. Twilley was just 20 years old when the band scored the deal. Ironically, they signed with the hometown label just after leaving L.A. for L.A. in search of a record deal. Twilley and Seymour were playing under the band name Oyster at the time. Each took chances pursuing music, Dwight dropping out of college and Phil leaving a different band, on the eve of recording to pursue the music Dwight was writing. Shelter released I'm On Fire as a single in 1975. The song was the biggest hit the band would score, going all the way to number 16 on the Billboard charts. With an appearance on American Bandstand and with a single in the charts, the band was poised to take off. Unfortunately, problems with Shelter would delay the release of an LP for 10 months, taking away a lot of that initial momentum. Here's Dwight Twilley Band with I'm On Fire.
Oh,
Did you play live often in the pre-record deal days?
Not really. I mean, we would have like cover bands. We could go out of town and play bars, you know, where you'd go and play seven sets and play Elvis and Beatles songs five times faster than they should ever be played. And that would give us money to like survive on and you know, buy equipment for our studio. But we never focused in on trying to make the live show get attention to our band. We were more into the idea of making a record that was strong enough to draw attention to us.
Your love for the record, is that kind of why it took some time between when you released I'm on Fire and your first LP? Mm-hmm. I read something we recorded in something like five studios with different producers, and was this because you were trying to perfect this album that you...
No, not really. It was just just fate. It was just right after that I'm on Fire had been released, they had planned on releasing three more singles before they released the album because they believed in it that much. But that's when the co-owners of Shelter Records was a company at the time, which was Denny Cordell and Leon Russell. All of a sudden, at that moment, they decided to split up. So it went into a whole legal mud pie. And they ended up having to get a whole new distributor. So all this time passed by before their album could be released, which was really unfortunate.
Oh, mercy.
Twilly Band with Looking for the Magic from 1977's Twilly Don't Mind. Tom Petty can be heard contributing backing vocals on that song. Twilly and Seymour also collaborated on Tom Petty's first record, most notably on the songs Breakdown and American Girl. This would be the second but last LP by the Dwight Twilley Band. Here's Dwight explaining why the group dissolved.
A lot of different things. I mean, for one thing, it seemed like, since we only released two albums, that it was all went by like a flash, but really we had worked for years, you know, on this whole deal. And there was disappointment because of the thing, of the label falling apart, right, and kind of killing the momentum of the band's, you know, introduction at the time. And we were disappointed that some of the records that we released, you know, like, for instance, Looking for the Magic, we all were just so convinced that it would be a hit record. I still can't quite understand why it wasn't a hit record, because people, to this day, I still get emails that it's an amazing amount of interest in that one particular song. And so, you know, we were kind of discouraged in that way. And then also, Phil was really, and rightly so, really kind of wanted to get out from behind the drums and be a front man in front of a group. And so, you know, it really was kind of more of a natural evolution than it seemed like. It seemed like they had a big fight and split up and it was all terrible. But, really Phil belonged to get out in front of a band, and we were both comfortable, and we remained, you know, great friends till he passed away.
Dwight Twilley with Runaway from his debut solo record titled Twilley. As you heard Dwight say, the breakup of the group was amicable, and Seymour and Twilley continued to collaborate after the group dissolved. Phil Seymour released two solo records in the early 80s and collaborated on several other projects throughout the years. Unfortunately, he passed away in 1993 of lymphoma at the age of 41. In 1984, Dwight Twilley again had a song in the charts. It came with the song Girls, which also features backing vocals by Tom Petty. Here's part of our interview, which features Dwight talking about what he did to promote the song, followed by the song that reached number 16 on the Billboard 100 in 1984.
Did you guys ever get involved in the marketing to make a hit? Because you know how to write a hit, and the songs are evident of that. But did you ever get too involved in how some of these songs were hits, especially back in the mid-70s to mid-80s? Was it a flip of the coin to you? Do you still...
Well, yeah, the only time that I really got involved was when the Girls came along. And but at that point, it had been a while since I had a big record, and so I wanted one pretty bad. So I did, make a few moves to, make sure that something was going to happen. For instance, I had in my contract, at the time, a video was real important. And, but I didn't have a video in my contract, and they're pretty expensive. And so what I did was I just went to EMI every day, and I just sat in their video room and watched videos all day long. I mean, every day. And occasionally someone would wander through and say, like, what are you doing? And I would just say, well, I'm looking at videos. I'm kind of interested in seeing, who are the good directors? Who's, making good videos these days? And lo and behold, and after, three or four weeks of just everybody seeing me in there day after day after day after day, finally somebody from the marketing department, came in with the same question, what are you doing? And I rattled off my story, and the next thing you know, I was making a video. And because of the title of the song, the Playboy Channel got involved in it and dumped some extra money into it. And so not only did we have the video for Girls, but we also had the R version, which was a rarity at the time. And that became a great promotional tool because the promo guys could say, well, we'd really like you to add this Dwight Twilley record to your playlist. And they'd be, well, I'm not sure if we can do that. I'm not sure. We've got some other songs we really, would getting a lot of pressure to put those on instead. And the promo guy would say, well, he's got a video. Would you like to see the video? Well, yeah, I'd like to see the video. I've seen it on MTV. It's doing pretty well on MTV. I don't really need to see it. And the promo guy could come back and go, yeah, but would you like to see the R-rated video? So that became kind of a promotional tool in itself. We'll be right back.
Were you ever commissioned to work solely as a songwriter for other musicians?
No, not commissioned. No.
Were you ever interested in doing that?
Not particularly. I had so much going on, it was all I could do to write the songs for what we were doing. And you know, it's kind of like when you say you get involved in the marketing, it's like I was able to do that with girls, and you kind of can at first, but the minute that you get your record rolling and you jump on the bus and start going across the country, you don't really have a lot of time left to do much, but, you know, go there, do the show, do the radio interview, and meet the fans, and do the press. That's, you know, that's your time is kind of consumed.
Twilly Band with Shaken in the Brow Grass, a track that was left unreleased until 1993. Before that, you heard Dwight's 1984 hit Girls. In 1987, on the verge of releasing his follow-up to the successful album Jungle, his label, Private Records, found itself in the middle of a payola scandal, canceling plans for the follow-up record. Here's Dwight discussing the incident.
See, I was reading the pretty in-depth piece that Kent Benjamin wrote about you.
Uh-huh.
And he was writing about how in later 1987, your manager was one of the high-profile cases involved in the whole payola scandal. And he wrote that, I wasn't sure if he was saying that you felt this or he thought you were blacklisted because of this incident. Is this true?
Well, it wasn't my manager. It was the head of the record company. The guy that owned private Records. His name was Joe Iskrow. And he had lured me out of EMI because one of my key contact guys was leaving there, and I was disappointed in some of the things that they were doing, and so I came to his label, and I was finished the big follow-up to Jungle, my most successful album, Jungle, and I was very excited about it. And about 2 weeks before the record was going to be released, there on the NBC Nightly News is Joe Iskrow with FBI footage of him meeting with the Gambino family. And so it just became a huge scandal. And more or less, my record just kind of disappeared in it. And then after that, it was, you know, it was really hard to get to find any interest in what I was doing from any of the labels.
Do you think that was because of your association with Phil, or do you know why that the lack of interest was such?
Well, by that time, it was kind of like everybody got the sense that, if you had had a hit or two, then the cards were kind of stacked against you. The opposite of what you'd think. You would think if you'd had a few hits that you'd be more desirable, but it was actually the opposite because, you know, if you're an A&R man and getting ready to sign somebody, and let's say you sign Dwight Twilley and he gets a hit record, it's like, why, what a talented guy Dwight Twilley is. But if you sign Joe Blackburger and he gets a hit record, it's what a genius the A&R man was.
So it wasn't because of the Paola scandal you had trouble?
No, but as far as the Wild Dogs album getting buried, I think that was, there was definitely a feeling of nobody wanted anything happy to happen with anything that this person was involved in at the time, because it was all under a huge microscope.
And every day I've been wanting you more, and every way I've been needing you more. I knew I'd find you in the world wouldn't last. The world wouldn't last. And I've been looking for a dream.
Dwight Twilley as part of Dwight Twilley Band performing the song Look Like an Angel. Listening to Connecting the Notes, thank you for joining us this hour. Dwight Twilley was kind enough to talk with the show earlier this week, and we would like to extend our thanks to him as well. So far, we have been listening to a lot of Twilley's older work, but he remains busy with music today. Around 1994, he built his own recording studio called Big Oak Recording Studio, just after returning to his hometown of Tulsa, Oklahoma. From his seat in the producer's chair in Tulsa, he is far removed from the lawsuits, bad breaks, and legal troubles that haunted his earlier work. He's self-releasing much of his music now, and just by logging online, you can find over 150 songs of his. Here he is discussing this newfound freedom.
And are you self-releasing? You're doing your own work in your own studio now?
Yeah, we have our own studio, the Big Oak Studio, here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It was like kind of towards the end of that time, I'd kicked around the beginning of the 90s, and I wrote a book that came out and did that motif, and I was still recording with Richie Podler and Bill Cooper up at American Studios, and a huge production team of Richie Podler and Bill Cooper, and we were recording what we thought were great records and really couldn't get any interest in anyone to sign me. And it was so, I kind of felt like no direction. It was kind of like a downer time. And then this wonderful thing happened. We had the Northridge earthquake, which destroyed my house, to the point where, by law, I had to leave my house, physically get out of my house, because it was that badly damaged. And that forced me to make an interesting decision, which was to move back to my hometown, Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I was fortunate enough at the time that I had song Why You Want to Break My Heart in the number one soundtrack Wayne's World, and so I was able to comfortably move back to Tulsa and build my own recording studio. And since then, I probably have made more records than a lot of people have made in their whole careers just since I've been back here, and it's just been terrific.
So have you kind of enjoyed having this freedom? Like, do you think this would have been possible to make a Christmas album and a live album and have 150 tracks back in say the 70s and 80s when you were bouncing around from
different labels? No, not at all. Yeah, no, I have usually had to beg people to come in the studio at like midnight or 1 in the morning after the other band left and get, you know, just to get a little bit of studio time and to get something done. Now I work when I want, as much as I want, and it's my studio, so nobody can tell me to turn it off or turn it on, you know. But I'm kind of a workaholic, and I'm pretty self-contained. My wife, Jan, is the engineer, and I'm still working with Bill Pickock IV, who also lives here in Tulsa. And really, between myself, Jan, and Bill Pickock IV, and there's just an amazing number of great musicians in Tulsa. That's a whole other story to itself, but it's pretty easy to knock out a record, very, very self-contained.
I had a dream about you. I've always said it's not true. Well, I always knew, no matter what they say or do, that I find you. Run away. There's a little less love in this world. It was a long time ago and it was far away, but I remember it all like it was yesterday. There's a little less love in this world. Don't you remember?
Listening to, you know, much of the new music now that's coming out?
I know. I never was a real big listener. I never really ran out to hear somebody else's record. I always felt like it, you know, if an important record came out, it just always seemed like it ended up in my lap. I never searched for it. And, you know, listening to something else, it's like I don't want somebody else's melody in my head. I'm trying to write my own songs. It's almost confusing to me.
Do you think the day of the huge hit taking over the country has kind of passed now?
Well, you know, rock and roll is pretty dead in general, and I'm considered myself a rock artist. So it's more for the, it became such a big machine, a business machine that lawyers run, and with it's more about fashion than it is about great music these days, I believe.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, they've, you know, it's kind of been destroyed. I feel like that I was lucky to, you know, be in the last couple of years of, you know, when people knew the name of a record and the artist that had the number one record or had a hit. Nowadays, you say, have you heard the number one record? Someone would say, on what chart?
Right.
Because there's so many, it's all so divided. I mean, in the early days, you could turn on the radio and you'd hear the Beach Boys, and then right after, you could hear James Brown. And then you'd hear, like, Lauren Green, you know, narrating some song about a gunslinger. So it was, and or Frank Sinatra could be on, all those on the same radio station. And now there's, like, 20 different radio stations that only play this kind or that kind of music, and it's you know, one way to destroy things is to divide it up. And I think that's what's happened over the last decade. So I'm just focused on just the magic of making the music, you know. I still love it so much that I'm, you know, I'm very content.